Good morning, good afternoon, good evening. My name is Marty Plum, and I am your host of A Pen and a Napkin Podcast, a weekly coaching clinic you can carry around with you in your pocket. We are back with the coaching staff on the other line. I have the, I don't even know any famous soccer coaches, but he's fresh off of a 2-0 win. How do you like that soccer verbiage there, Mr. Viss? Nil.
I'm impressed with the nil.
Yes. A 2-0 victory after a solid week of training out on the pitch. Mr. Tony D. Viss. Tony, how we doing, buddy?
I don't know if I could be doing any better. It's like 70 degrees here, hardly any wind, and yeah, I don't know if life gets a whole lot better.
I took a nice solid 2.5 mile walk today after school. Ooh. Yeah, that was feeling good, Clark. Feeling good. So, episode number 81, and this week we are going to talk about some of the lessons we have learned from watching the NCAA tournament. But before we do that, we of course have some uniform numbers. Tony, all football players.
I feel good on these.
Okay.
Maybe.
I've got 5 wide receivers, a defensive lineman, and a defensive back.
Oh boy. Yeah. I'm going to struggle on the defensive back.
Okay.
Maybe even the defensive lineman. Okay. I'll start defensive lineman because I've got one in my head. Was Ted Hendricks? Was he, or was it Hendrickson or something like that? Was
Ted Hendricks? Nope.
Okay.
Nope.
So that screws me over. Let's go wide receivers. The infamous Terrell Owens.
Correct.
Feeling good. How many more I got for wide receivers?
4.
Oh boy.
These are all pretty well known guys. They're all either in the Hall of Fame or borderline Hall of Famers.
Okay. 81 wide receiver. We did T.O. 80. Was one of the Sharp brothers 81?
No.
No.
Not in my...
But Sterling might be.
No.
See, Andre Reed was 83 or something like that, 84 maybe.
Let's see.
Is one of them a Dallas Cowboy?
No, no. One of Tom Brady's famous favorite targets.
Wes Welker?
Nope. Much more.
Not Danny Amendola, is it?
No, you got to go wider split. A wider receiver outside. Long bombs.
Was it Randy Moss, was it?
Randy Moss.
You were 81 with the Patriots, okay.
I think so.
All right.
Let's see here. One of Joe Theismann's favorite targets. Perhaps his favorite target.
Gary Clark.
Nope. Played alongside Gary Clark. Art Monk. There's another one. Part of the greatest show on turf.
Oh, Torrey Holt.
There it is. Famous Oakland Raider.
Cliff Branch.
No. Second go around with the Oakland Raiders.
Second go around with the Oakland Raiders. Tim Brown?
There it is. All right.
And we got a defensive lineman and a DB.
Yeah, defensive lineman, 60s and 70s, DB, 50s and 60s. But they're really famous. They're famous, but I don't know. It's going to be really hard, I guess.
Okay.
Purple People Eater, defensive lineman.
Alan Page.
Nope. Played alongside.
Carl Eller.
There it is. And Detroit Lion, defensive back.
Lane?
Huh?
Bobby Lane?
Not Bobby Lane. Lane is correct. Dick Night Train Lane.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
It was Dick, not Bobby.
Yeah, yeah. It's okay.
I was going to say Night Train, but then I was like, I didn't know.
Yeah, that's all right. That's all right. Hey, not a bad run. Not a bad run. So Tony and I were talking what we're going to talk about this week, and kind of popped into my head, hey, we just went through – 100 and, you know, even if you include the NIT, hundreds of terrific games here at the end of the college basketball season. And we just want to talk about some of the things that we observe, some of the things that you as coaches could take back to your teams next season. You know, and I guess I erred towards, for the most part, common sense or universal themes on my list, Tony. You know, UConn runs this seven different option weave action to get a lob for their 7-2 guy. Well, most of us aren't going to be able to run that, you know. I was looking kind of from the 30,000 foot view on it, Tony. So, but yeah, let's dive into it. I'll let you lead off here.
Probably the biggest thing, and it's been, I've moved this way over the last few years, but this one here really kind of solidified it. Offense wins. That's probably the one of the biggest, like, reinforcements from this is offense wins. You know, I used to be a big defensive guy and still am. I love that end of the floor. I love the chess piece stuff and how to slow teams down a little bit and so on and so forth. But offense wins. If you go through and you take a look at the teams, you know, you had some teams that were pretty gritty on the defensive end, but they were, to be nice, offensively challenged.
Yeah.
And due to that fact, they didn't punch their tickets further in the dance as they could have. And then you go and you take a look, whether it is UConn, like you mentioned, running the sets that they ran, and to be honest with you, the South Carolina women, it was about offense for them as well. And I know some people, oh, come on, Tony, they play really good defense. 100%, you got to play both ends well. But if you go back the previous year, I think South Carolina scored 73 against Iowa. And that's not bad. 73 is nothing to sneeze at.
Yeah.
But this year they put up 87, and they really improved their outside shooting. So probably the biggest thing, again, in this day and age, offense wins.
Yeah. The difference between Iowa winning and Iowa losing, because I had 77 last year when they beat them, and 73 or 75.
Five,
75.
Think, yeah.
87, 75. So Iowa played pretty much the same game offensively. Mm-hmm. South Carolina shot it way better. And as we were watching the game play out, not to go on too deep of a dive here, but I told Carlos, we were watching, I was like, if South Carolina continues to shoot like this, Iowa doesn't stand a chance. And that's what happened. So that was probably number one on my list. Tony, you have to have players that can make plays, when things break down. Bill Simmons calls it, I got this guy, you know, hey, give me the ball, I got this. Mm-hmm. And players that can just make those type of plays. And, you know, you saw Iowa kind of ride that all the way to the national championship game. You know, South Carolina had a lot of, you know, very, very balanced. South Carolina and UConn were pretty similar in their way that their teams were set up. But you've got to have kids, unless you're overwhelmingly deep and balanced like both of the champions were, you're going to have players that just make plays. And you know, in a perfect world, you have multiple of them, you know. So I really shifted, like you, Tony, I really shifted my focus as I became more seasoned and experienced. We worked very little on defensive development. I mean, we would talk about it like in league games or, you know, summer camp games or whatever. Hey, jump to the ball, do this or that. But our open gyms were, if we had an hour, you know, 55 minutes was on offense, you know, and skill development and making that the focus, because that just takes so much more time, effort, and energy to develop that. And like you said, the game has evolved with the way it's officiated, with the way that the players are today. If you don't have kids that can put the ball in the basket and make plays for themselves, the hey, I got this type of folks, the good teams are going to have them, and you're not going to beat them. So I think that is kind of the coin of the realm right now. I think that's, you know, we're seeing that shift in the game, aren't we, Tony?
Most definitely. And I would go back and give you more, you know, examples, if you will. Number one, when LSU beat Iowa the year before, they shot the crap out of it from three in the national championship game. Didn't do that in the regional final.
Yep.
And then if you go back, Raven Johnson for South Carolina was devastated the year before because Caitlin Clark's telling the defenders to get off of her and let her shoot it outside. They didn't need to do that as much this year because she made them pay when they laid off of her. And then Iowa, you know, when the game kind of slipped away a little bit, they missed open looks. And again, if you can make open shots consistently, you will win games, a lot of games.
Yeah, absolutely. The next thing I had, Tony, I think experience matters. One thing that we've learned here, and we'll talk about Calipari later, but you know, his team stayed young while a lot of other people got old. And again, COVID, the transfer portal, a lot of those things played into it. But you've got to probably collect some scars along the way. You've got to work your way through it. Again, UConn, kind of the exception to the rule because they lost all those guys, but then they all came, you know, they ended up running on the table. But you take a look at South Carolina. They had to collect the scar of losing in the Final Four. You had to take a look at Purdue losing embarrassingly in a couple of times in the tournament to some very, you know, some low-seeded teams, obviously. You know, you got to have experience. You got to have guys. You know, NC State had two or three fourth and fifth year guys in their starting lineup. They were a very experienced team on the men's side. So I really think that, you know, you saw Paige Beckers beat Juju Watkins in the regional final there with UConn. Experience matters, and if you think in this day and age, it's getting harder and harder for just that stud to come in and carry you. You've got to be extremely, extremely talented, whatever that level may be. I mean, we've seen this in our state the last 4 years. We've had a gal named Britt Prince who is absolutely outstanding, and she came in as a freshman and, you know, won four state championships as the best player on her team 4 years in a row. That's really, really hard to do. We even, you know, again, Iowa had to lose to Creighton in the round of 32 before they made this run the last couple of years. A lot of people forget that. A lot of, you know, forget that heartbreak. And so sometimes you got to collect those scars and you got to have that experience in order to be as successful as you want to be to take those steps along the way, because it's not a microwave fix. It's a slow cooker type of deal there. So that's something I picked up on.
And that's the crazy thing, Marty. When you take a look at college, fourth and fifth year players, all the rage right now. Mm-hmm. And that's a big part of why Cal is out at Kentucky. And again, we'll get to that later on. Mm-hmm. But when you take a look, UConn, one of the key pieces for UConn was Spencer, the transfer in from Rutgers.
Mm-hmm.
You take a look at Purdue, the 55 for them that transferred in from Southern Illinois.
Yep.
And, you know, and again, we could sit here, I think NC State's almost their entire starting lineup was grad transfers, basically.
Yep.
And it's all the rage. But then you turn around and the NBA, you know, the seasoned and experienced isn't in vogue still. You want the Victor Wembanyama, the unicorns, if you will,
mm-hmm.
and you want to get the potential.
Yeah.
But in the NCAA, you want those who have been through the wars, that maybe have had their heart broken. I think it was Doug Collins when he was talking about when the Bulls finally, you know, took down the Pistons. You have to have your heart broken in the middle in a million pieces before you can get to where you want to go. And it was like the Pistons had their heart broken by the Celtics.
Yep.
And just kind of that passing of the torch, if you will.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think the blueprint is, to borrow a football reference, is, you know, Belichick kind of divided his roster into thirds. I think Bill Walsh kind of did the same thing. You know, a third of your roster with guys kind of on their way out towards the end of their career, a third of your guys in the prime of their career, and a third of your guys young starting out their career. And I think, yeah, you take a look at like UConn's, again, let's take a look at our two champions. You know, the South Carolina women had the, what's the big, the center's name?
Cardozo.
You know, she's a senior. You know, she's been around forever. They've got a couple other kids. They had the transfer come in, the really good shooter. I see her face, Topopo or...
Oh, yeah.
You know. But then they had the two freshmen that played terrific coming off the bench. You know, and with UConn, you had, like you said, the guy from Rutgers, Simpson or Samson or whatever.
Spencer, sorry.
Slippy, slappy, swimmy, swammy. Check the briefcase. Samsonite. I was way off. You had started with an S. Ooh, 14 minutes and 52 seconds.
It's not bad. It's not bad. It's better sometimes.
Yeah. But, you know, he's 24 years old, but they're relying on him, and they're relying on the Castle kid. By the way, shout out, Stefan Castle, his dad, Stacy Castle, graduate of the Harvard of the Heartland, Briarcliff University. Yeah, graduated a year after me. So,
wow.
Yeah. But yeah, I think that's what your rosters need to be, especially in this era of COVID and kids sticking around. And I think we're going to see more kids sticking around, not making that leap to try and make the NBA money because of the NIL stuff. And so I think that's going to be a trend as well, Tony. So we could see a little bit of a renaissance in the game in that regard.
Yeah, you're going to see more of the, you know, sticking around. The NIL has leveled that playing field. I know there was a story, AJ Storr left Wisconsin, went in the transfer portal, and told Kansas, take it or leave it, it's $1 million. Kansas offered him $750,000, and he left it. And it's like, oh, that's different. And I think that's going to be a big part of why you see the G League, like those overtime elite and different things like that. I think that's why you're going to see them fold, because they're not going to be able to compete with the colleges and the NIL thing.
Mm-hmm. Coaches, get signed up today for the 4th annual A Pen and a Napkin Coaches Clinic. This year's clinic will take place on Saturday, April 27th at the AEF Basketball Academy facility located at South 99th Circle and Portal Road in La Vista, Nebraska. We've got a great lineup of speakers, starting out with 3 on-court demonstrations. Justin Carter, former Creighton basketball player and owner and founder of ProVision Basketball here in Omaha. He's going to do some essential skills and drills for player development. Dave Hubert, the head girls basketball coach at Ashland Greenwood High School, is going to do defensive principles and drills. Mark Sfigera, the head men's basketball coach at my alma mater, the Harvard of the Heartland, Briarcliff University. Great offensive mind, and he's going to talk about offensive basketball. One of the great things that we do at a Pen and a Napkin Clinic is we have our classroom sessions during our lunches. We've got 3 great speakers to come in this year to talk during our lunches. Jim Simons, the head boys basketball coach at Omaha Westside, is going to talk about using the 3-point shot. Andy Gerlez, my good friend G, going to talk about building a program foundation and practice principles from Papillion-La Vista South. And Tyler Bird, the Think Shrink, you heard him on the podcast a few weeks ago. He's going to talk about mental health for coaching and keeping balance in your coaching life. And then we're going to have 2 breakout sessions. That's probably the thing that makes a Pen and a Napkin Clinic the most unique thing, is you're going to sit around and you're going to talk with random coaches about random topics and pick the brains of random coaches that are going to be there for the clinic. Along with that, once the clinic is done, perhaps the best part of the clinic, I don't know, there's a lot of good things about the clinic, is our post-clinic social. And that's going to be at Wine 121, located at 120th and Center here in Omaha. Just $15 per coach if you want to attend that. Again, it's all about the coaches, and I try to keep it really, really affordable. This year, for one coach, for over 7 hours worth of stuff, $50. That's about $7 an hour to get great information. 2 coaches from a staff, $90 or $45 a piece. 3 coaches from the same staff, $120, so $40 a piece. If you have 4 or more coaches from your staff, that's $35. That's $5 an hour that you're going to pay for your whole staff to have a great day of knowledge and learning things. So if you're interested in signing up for the clinic, look for our flyer on Twitter, or you can email me, apenandanapkin@gmail.com. You can DM me on Twitter. Registrations are due Thursday, April 25th. Have to do that for the lunch count and make sure that we're taken care of there. But coaches, you will not regret signing up for the 4th annual A Pen and a Napkin Coaches Clinic. Do that today. What else you got, Tony?
You know, another thing I thought was really kind of cool with this one was just the quality of sportsmanship.
That just
kind of emanated throughout. You know, Matt Painter had some really, really good quotes, and I've admired Matt Painter from afar for a while, but just watching what he had to say was just super impressive. Dawn Staley, super impressive. You know, I remember what she said right before they took the trophy, and how she, shouted out Caitlin Clark for all the pressure she was dealing with and the way that she had elevated the women's game. And you know, when you saw over 4 million viewers for the women's championship game than what you did the men's, first time in the history. in the history of the NCAA tournament. And so you have that going on. And then you take a look, you know, Caitlin Clark just signing the autographs and, you know, taking the time to make sure, and then listening to what do you hope they remember about you? Well, we don't really necessarily care if they remember the fact that we made it to back-to-back finals, but the way that we made them feel and how we inspired the younger kids and different things there. And then the way Lisa Bluter addressed the locker room, you know, after the game, and to keep their heads high and stuff like that. But just the importance of life lessons and doing things the right way and being classy. I just think there's a lot of that that maybe slips through the cracks if you don't pay close attention to it. Mm. And that was one thing that I just was really, really appreciative of with this, you know, postseason run by it that was able to pay attention to there.
Yeah. Next one I had, Tony, most of the time, and we saw this with a lot of our teams here, when you play in a tournament, you're very rarely going to play, you know, in this case, six perfect games in a row, you're going to have one game along the way where you just, it's a grind. You just don't have it. But you've got to find a way to win it. Now, again, UConn kind of the outlier to that.
Yeah.
But for South Carolina, they had a dogfight against Indiana, I believe, in the Sweet 16. Iowa had a dogfight with West Virginia in the round of 32. On the men's side, Alabama had a haymaker of a fight with Grand Canyon in the second round. I think it was the round of 32. You know, Tennessee made a nice run, but their game against Texas, they did not play very well, but they still found a way to win it. So I think as you start looking at your season, and one of the things that I've really thought about more the last few years, and I think I did a better job of it, we always anticipate that our teams are going to play well, or that's a lot of us tend to be optimistic, and we get frustrated when we're not playing well. I think you have to have a plan mentally of how you're going to react, how you're going to coach your team if you don't have it on a given night. And I think when you get to your postseason next year, I think you've got to realize, hey, if we have aspirations to make a long run, we have to be prepared that somewhere along this journey, we're just not going to have it. We're just not going to play as well as what we would like, and we've still got to find a way to win it. So what's my body language going to be like as a coach? How am I going to handle huddles? How am I going to handle timeouts? How am I going to handle halftime? How am I going to handle my substitution pattern? I think those are things that you can, you know, even at this time, you could kind of start thinking about a little bit and prepare for that, because you're, you know, for our high school coaches listening, you're going to have that this summer. You're going to get to the third game of a four-game team camp in one day, and your kids are tired and, you know, whatever, you know, how are you going to handle that? You know, so I think that was something I really took from the tournament this year.
Most definitely. You know, like you mentioned, UConn was probably that one team that didn't have that. And I'll go back to our experience with making it to the state title game. Obviously, we lost the state championship, but we were very, very fortunate to get even to the state tournament because we had to survive North Scott. We barely were able to hold them off in the regional final. And so, yeah, I mean, it's something that you have to be able to do, and it's tough. How are you going to handle that? And your kids will build on that. Are you going to be poised, or are you going to be panicked? Because that's the type of environment that they've got to be able to handle, and you want them to be poised. And it's one of those things where you're going to have to roll your sleeves up. You're going to have to get your hands dirty, and you're going to have to grind it and grit it out on the defensive end especially.
Mm-hmm. Okay. What else you got, buddy?
You know, one of the things that just continues to stand out, this is kind of going back a little bit off the first one that I mentioned, is the importance of shooters. You know, with today's game, the modern, you know, pace and space, if you will, you have to have shooters on the floor to make sure that the defense is extended. So you open up those driving lanes, you take away that as many of the double team options as you can. But that is something that's very, very important as the shooter. And if you have somebody on your team who's really, really good and they've got to run that double team off them, you have to have that shooter, whether it's the same side or whether it's a weak side skip. But you have to have that shooter out there to make sure that you can keep teams honest, because there are going to be times when teams are flat out going to make you hit an outside shot to beat them. And you have to have those players on the floor. It's not just one shooter anymore, two shooters. The important thing is to have three, four shooters on there, a lot of five-out sets, because a lot of teams play that way with the cuts and different things, that looking for the mismatch and stuff like that. But yes, you have to have shooters in order for the floor to be balanced, in order for the floor to be spaced, and for your offense to flow efficiently.
Yeah. Well, and you know, kind of the same situation. We play in high school gyms all season, and then you get down to the state tournament, what are you playing in? You're playing in an arena. And yep, that is to the advantage of great shooters. I mean, if you're an okay shooter, if you're an average shooter, more than likely your shooting percentage is going to go down. And it's probably going to go down anyway, just because you're playing really, really good teams. You're probably going to be a little nervous, a little bit tight, you know, squeeze the ball a little bit more than you normally would, you know, so forth and so on. But it does allow, you know, shooting is the great equalizer. We saw that with Kentucky and Oakland, where the
transfer. I think he was a D2 guy.
Yeah. But, you know, he goes nuts and hits 10 threes, you know, or whatever. And so there, that the, just the threat of shooters and having those shooters out there. Now, if those shooters can just put it on the floor a little bit, then you're going to be in even better shape. I mean, that's where you, that's championship material right there, obviously. And those teams are hard to find. But you know, like in the men's championship game, UConn went straight up. They went one-on-one in the post, and they could, you know, Edie had nobody to throw it to, but when those kids got it, they couldn't create off the bounce against Kentucky's kids. Those kids were so used to having teams send 3, 4, 5 people at Edie that they were just shooting the catch and shoot threes, and they had no off the bounce game. So you got to have, you know, with those shooters, hopefully you got a little bit of balance too. So does that all make sense, Tony?
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, okay. Mental toughness, another thing, Tony, and that kind of goes back to, you know, not playing your best game. I mean, it's hard to win. I really believe that getting a win in the tournament, unless you are outstanding and the other team is not good, like really, really not good, if it's any sort of competitive game, I always feel like the energy and the intensity of a tournament game, it's like winning 2 regular season games. You know, that's what you have to put into it. And so, you know, just the mental toughness. Now, it kind of, I want to, you know, put that together with another thing that I had written down, Tony. You also have to kind of be peaking at the right time, mentally and physically. And if you have the ability, now, not everybody's in the same boat, obviously. You can't, sometimes you just got to scrap for wins all season long. Other teams can experiment with things a little bit and build up to the end of the season a little bit more. But you've got to build that mental toughness every single day. Even if you're going non-contact shooting practice for an hour on a Saturday morning, there's got to be some sort of mental toughness equivalency in that practice, because you've got to have your kids be ready to take it to another level when necessary. Again, South Carolina and Connecticut both did that to a high degree, especially Connecticut. It was just so impressive to see them kind of in a Golden State Warriors third quarter type of way. The way they extended these last two games out early in the second half was really, really impressive to see. And you could tell those, you know, these are two really, really mentally tough teams. Not to say that the other teams that played aren't mentally tough, but boy, you know, you've got to be mentally tough, but you've also got to get your team peaking at the right time. And if we had the right formula for that, everybody would share it. You know, Kevin Keats got his team peaking at the right time, got a little lucky, you know, that type of thing. But that mental component is so very, very important. Short turnaround, you're tired. You have additional media attention that you never had before. That's a mentally draining thing, you know? So I think that's a big thing that just reminded me how important that is while I was watching the teams play the last few weeks.
Yeah, and it's one of those things where, you know, you talk about the grind. And one of the things that you can do towards the end of the year, and we've talked about this before, is kind of cut back the amount of practice time. So you're not in there killing them, but when you're in there, it's got to be sharp.
Yep.
And it has to be, you know, one of those things where you've got to go at a high level. I know I was reading through some stuff about UConn, and one of them said, you know, this time of the year, teams aren't putting in 2.5 hour practices. We are. That's what separates us. But, you know, not that I'm disagreeing, because obviously it works for them, but I think you can sometimes work smarter, not always harder on that.
Mm-hmm. I've got one more thing left, Tony. How many more things you got?
I've got one, but I thought I had another one. So if it comes back to me, I didn't write it down, unfortunately, but while you were talking, something came to me. But if it pops back in there, if I have a brilliant moment, I'll try to share it.
I'll wait anxiously for that brilliant moment.
My last one that I would go with is the ability to change up defenses. The one thing that really kind of threw me for both the men's and the women's tournament is how effective zone was from time to time. And I know Iowa and a few other teams as well also didn't go just straight zone. They also threw a little junk in there with a diamond and one, box and one, triangle and two, whatever. But just the ability to change defenses and give teams different looks, I think, was super important down the home stretch.
I really believe, and it depends on what order you want to go in, and whatever is best for your team, whatever is best for your philosophy. But I really believe by the end of the season, you've got to feel comfortable in the half court with a man option, a zone option, and a junk option. I don't know if you can do much more than that, especially at the high school level. Now, again, when you're at the Division I, that level, and dealing with those type of players, you should be able to do more things out of it. But as high school coaches, if you're just going to say, hey, we are just a straight man-to-man team, and this is what we do, I mean, hats off to you, and if it works for you, awesome. I think that's really, really hard to do. You've got to be really uber talented to be able to do that and do it effectively. And like I said, if you disagree, that's fine. That's why this game is great, because there's a million different ways you can coach it. But I really think, yeah, going into the postseason, you need one man, one zone, and one junk. That even if you just need to use it for 3 or 4 possessions, you have to be able to use it. And I agree with you, Tony, that we saw that from a lot of different teams. Just the way that they changed things up, the way coaches adapted their defenses to the personnel and what those teams were doing to them. So I really like that one there. So did that brilliant idea come to you?
It did.
Okay.
It did.
Okay. Before you forget... Let's go.
You had said when you were talking, Marty, about winning is really, really hard. And the one thing that kind of stood out to me was you can see an occasional upset, you know, whether that's Oakland taking down Kentucky, whether that's, you know, a few of the other big time upsets out there. But more and more with winning is hard, in this one especially, I thought you saw the cream rise to the top.
Yeah.
We had 2 number one seeds in the men. That hasn't happened in a long time. Mm-hmm. You go to the women, Iowa and South Carolina, I think were the 1 and 2 overall ranked. I know they were both one seeds. But again, you saw the cream rise to the top. And in the tournament, you may see an occasional upset here and there, but the Cinderellas don't usually go dancing. It's those teams that can bring it consistently, time in and time out. It's not that occasional fluky game. And don't get me wrong, I love the occasional fluky game. I think that's what makes the NCAA tournament the greatest tournament in the world, and it should not be changed because of that.
Yeah, you had NC State with the run, but they're coming from a Power Five, it's you gotta have the horses from start to finish, and I agree that's a good one there. So, kind of with that, Tony, it's somewhat related. One thing that I took from this tournament is something that you really can't control as a coach most of the time, health. You know, we had some really good teams. Kansas had, you know, one of their best players not play at all, and Hunter Dickinson was not much. You know, he was kind of a shell of himself there with his injury. Marquette with Kolick. Although he played, you know, but I don't know if he was at 100%. And then, you know, Houston, who I think would have been a really, really intriguing matchup with Connecticut if they would have been able to get through there, just because of their their mental makeup, the way that they play the game. I thought they kind of had the and I don't mean this in any negative way towards anybody that played Connecticut along the way, especially like Purdue, but I thought Houston had the mental juice, the attitude that was right on par with Connecticut. But Snead, that did I get that name right? I think I got that name right.
No, when Jamal Shed. Shed.
I haven't gotten one game name right on. I know who I was talking about, but he hurts his ankle against Duke. He's their best offensive player on a team that is offensively challenged. Mm-hmm. They end up losing a game that probably 8 times out of 10 they end up winning, you know. So again, sometimes you can control health by resting your kids and keeping them fresh, but there's things that just you can't have or that you have no control over. So you got to be healthy, you got to be a little bit lucky, and those are some you know, that's how you get to the end of the road there, you know. So that's what I got, buddy.
Yeah, those are good. And just in terms of the luck, you know, you mentioned Kevin Keats earlier. They're tied late, Marty, with Louisville. If they get beat by Louisville after having lost the last 4 regular season games in a row, and they played really good teams. I want to say, you know, Duke, North Carolina, and maybe one of them twice. They played really, really good teams at the end. But if they get beat by Louisville, he probably gets fired.
And they're hiring Tony Viz.
Yeah, and they're firing somebody. They're definitely not me. And then they get Virginia. Virginia's 80% free throw shooter misses a free throw, and I believe O'Connell banks it in to go to overtime. They win that game. And then they get into the NCAA tournament and just get on a roll. And, you know, now this guy, you know, I wouldn't necessarily say he has a lifetime contract, but the water is not nearly as hot as what it was.
A Pen and a Napkin University videos are just another way that a pen and a napkin can help you become a better coach. Our university video library is constantly expanding with topics ranging from interviewing for a job to full court defense to 25 universal truths about coaching. Our university videos will help you round out your skill set as a coach and help you hone your craft. Videos are $10 a piece with bundling options available. To order, you can DM me on Twitter, send me an email at apenandanapkin@gmail.com, or order from our website, apenandanapkin.com. Be sure to check out the A Pen and a Napkin video library. It's a crazy game, Tony. But you know who is especially crazy, Tony?
Ozzy Osbourne with Crazy Train?
We're going off the rails.
Europe. I'm sorry.
No, we're not changing.
Okay.
It is time for the coaching staff trivia. Mr. Viss, are you ready for trivia this week?
As ready as ever.
All right. Tony, I'm going to zig here a little bit.
Oh, boy.
So we're taping this on Wednesday night. Sunday night, I'm watching television with Mrs. Plum. And we like to watch these shows on the History Channel, the foods that changed America or the foods that made America or whatever.
Yeah.
And they had an episode of the history of the growth of
Arby's.
Arby's. Tony. And so I texted Tony. I said, Tony, you got to turn to the History Channel right now. It's the history of Arby's. And my question to you, my friend, is to start off with, did you do so?
No, the Mrs. Viss had the controller at that time, and I believe we were watching Tracker or something like that. So, yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Tony, I have 4 trivia questions for you, and they're all related to the Arby's documentary from the other night.
Oh, crap. I know I should have turned it.
Oh, Rita, it's all your fault. It's all your fault. So, question number 1. What does the name Arby's stand for? You can mean 2 different things.
obviously the R and the B are roast beef.
That is one of them. Very good. Has to do with the RB. Roast beef is one.
Okay.
You probably not bread. The brothers that, and I forget their first names because I can't get any names right tonight, but the brothers, they were the Raffle Brothers, R-A-F-F-E-L, I believe is how they spelled it. So Raffle Brothers is also what the RB stands for. All right. So got a yes or no question for question number two, Tony.
I like that.
Okay. Has Arby's ever gone bankrupt?
I'm going to go with yes.
It did. Early on in its existence, it went bankrupt. They overextended when they were trying to franchise, and they went bankrupt. The bank got it back, and then the Raffle Brothers got it back within a year because it started to fail even worse, so blah, blah, blah. So, in what state did Arby's start in? I'll give you three guesses.
Oh, boy. Texas.
Incorrect. Good guess because of the cowboy hats and the roast beef.
Yeah. Yep. Let's stick in that part of our country.
I wouldn't do that.
Let's don't do that then. Let's go with Tennessee.
Closer. One more guess.
So we're closer with Tennessee. How about the bluegrass state of Kentucky?
Closer, but not close enough. Ohio.
Oh, Ohio.
Ohio. Fourth and final question about Arby's.
Thank God.
I had to do this. I had to do this. How many within 100, how many locations are there? How many Arby's locations are there around the world today?
Oh, wow. 350.
Oh, jeez. Way off. Knew it started with an S.
Am I too low?
Way too low. Worldwide.
750.
Way too low still.
1,500.
Way too low. 3,500 Arby's worldwide.
Dang.
Yeah.
It's a lot more popular than what I give it credit for.
Yeah. Well, the Raffle Brothers would not like that, Tony. They would not say to you...
It's an excellent segue.
They would be greatly insulted by that. So, oh, we just lost so many subscribers right now. This week in basketball. Let's go through the games. We kind of talked about them when we talked about the tournament here. We will try to be serious for a little while. Both teams were really dominant. I thought Alabama might give UConn a little bit more of a run for its money. I didn't think Alabama would win, it was a tough go for everybody except for UConn and South Carolina. The end of two tremendous careers for Zach Edey and Caitlin Clark and a lot of their supporting cast. Those teams will be much different next year. So, yeah, just Tony, kind of your overall read of the Final Fours of both genders.
You know, the thing that is just amazing is the growth and the popularity of the women's.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the women's tickets were, you want to go to the Final Four, were over $1,000.
Mm-hmm.
They had over 4 million viewers. Of the championship game, and Purdue and Connecticut were two good men's teams.
Mm-hmm.
And still got outdrawn over 4 million. You know, you go through, as far as stuff goes, the teams will, like you said, will look very, very different. I heard Purdue is bringing in a 7'2" freshman, but all the other guys have a chance to go back. But when you don't have Zach Edey, obviously that's tremendously different.
Yeah.
UConn, I think some of their young guys are going to go to the NBA. Wouldn't be surprised if Klingon goes. And then the freshman kid from Georgia was really, really good.
Yeah.
I would guess he's going to go as well. And then obviously they have some grad guys, whether it's Spencer, you know, I may be slappy, but I'm not real sure. Anyway, Spencer will be gone.
Yeah.
And then, you know, but the thing that's interesting to me is that with UConn, they weren't that they were rated super low, but they weren't rated really high because they had lost 5 out of their top 8.
Mm-hmm.
But they were even more impressive this year with their margin of victory than what they were the year before. I was actually very happy with Alabama. I think it was a 2-possession game at either the under 8 or under 4 media timeout.
Yeah.
And then obviously they got finished on. But UConn did that to everybody. I mean, one of the most amazing stats to me, I watched Illinois because obviously they were playing Iowa State. So I watched that game closely and I was impressed with Illinois.
Yeah.
And then UConn goes on a 30-0 run.
Illinois is really good, and they just treated them like the varsity was playing the 8th grade team.
Yes, just drubbed them, and so that was amazing. And the one thing I would end with as far as the Final Four stuff goes, parity to the women's game has done tremendous. It's been great. I mean, before, okay, it's going to be UConn and Tennessee in the final.
Mm-hmm.
You know, maybe an occasional Stanford in there too.
Yeah,
but then you see Kim Mulkey start to make some noise at Baylor, and you know, with the talent, the 5-star talent she was bringing in there. But now you have all of these different teams. Like there were 2-3 seeds that made it in, and I don't think any 2 seeds made it into the regional finals.
Mm-hmm.
And so the parity to the women's game has been a breath of fresh air.
Yes, very much so. Even my wife said that. Just to see NC State there, to see, you know, I mean, everybody thinks Iowa, and yeah, they've been a huge story the last 2 years, but, you know, I mean, they are new on the block relative to the Notre Dames, the UConns, the Stanfords, the Tennessee. I mean, you could set your clock to it for a stretch there, you know.
Yeah.
So that was nice to see. It was nice to see Southern Cal in the Elite Eight. You know, who were some other, I'd have to get out my bracket here to see it all, who was all in there. But it was nice to see some fresh faces, some new faces in the women's game. And, you know, the biggest thing that I would just say is the 2 best teams won. Just no doubt about it. The 2 best teams won. You know, it was impressive runs by both teams. I thought maybe, you know, Iowa got off to that 10-0 lead. I thought, oh man, maybe they'll get going here. And if South Carolina, you know, kind of one of those, we need to get up, we need to hold on to the lead pretty much the entire game. We know they're going to make a run at us at some point. Can we hold on? That's kind of what I was thinking was the path to victory for Iowa. And South Carolina just kept shooting it well. So, but I thought it was 2 really good tournaments. You know, I think it was good. I think it was good. So, coaches are absolutely loving our Taking Over a New Program booklet. As many of you know, I spent 2 years outside of coaching, and during that time, I hung a note card in my workspace at school that said, "Strip the house down to the studs." I took that time to really rethink and reorganize my thoughts on what it takes to run a transformational program. As I prepared for the possibility of coaching again, I organized these thoughts into this 96-page booklet. How much do I trust this booklet? I used this booklet as I went on interviews to help sell myself and my vision for what my new program would look like. If I'm using it to sell myself, why wouldn't I recommend it to you, my listeners? This booklet will help you look at any part of your program, no matter what stage you're at in your program, and help improve it in some way. It's all yours for only $15, which includes shipping and handling. For more information, email me at apenandanapkin@gmail.com. Let's talk a little coaching carousel, Tony. How's that sound?
Yeah.
Okay. Biggest one, one on the men's side here, the biggest one, kind of the surprise of the coaching carousel, is Calipari leaving Kentucky after 15 years going to Arkansas. But once you start drilling down on it a little bit, it's not that surprising. He had been there a long time. He had people in Kentucky had kind of gotten disenfranchised with him. I think he didn't feel as appreciated as he wanted to be. Now, again, he's feeling not appreciated making $8-9 million a year, you know, but still there's a personal pride with that. I think that it sounded like he was having some issues with his administration a little bit. You know, Kentucky fans are obviously some of the most passionate, if not the most passionate, college basketball fans in the country. It's a big, big job. But he goes to another really, really good job with a strong, passionate fan base who wants to take the next step. You know, Musselman moved on to USC. It's interesting that the guy from Kansas State and it was Jerome Tang, and who was the other two people that Arkansas offered it to or they brought in? It was Tang and
Was it Beard from Mississippi?
Oh, Beard. Yeah, Beard from Ole Miss. Ole Miss and Kansas State turned down Arkansas, but Kentucky says, I'll come. Boy, the world has turned a little upside down in that regard. But I think Calipari has a chance to do some really, really good things there, Tony. I think this might give him a bit of a shot in the arm the last 5 to 7 years of his career. And, you know, Arkansas has got a massive arena that they love to fill. They will come out and support the program. They're, like I said, they're passionate about their team. And I think it's got a real chance to work. So what are your thoughts on the Cal move?
The crazy thing here, Marty, is this all started when SMU let go of Lanier. And yep. He ended up landing a different job, too. Mm-hmm. But once that domino goes, Andy Enfield at USC is like, hey, SMU is going to the ACC. Mm-hmm. I'm kind of on the hot seat here at USC.
Unfairly.
Go there.
Yeah.
And then that opens up the USC job. And Eric Musselman is like, hey, we didn't have a great season at Arkansas. I might have a little bit more of a footing here at USC. So he goes to USC, which opens up Arkansas. And then Cal, because what do people want? People want job security, right?
Yeah.
They want to be appreciated.
Just like you
and I. And Cal knew that he was basically, if they kept doing what they've been doing for a while now, it's not like Kentucky's been, you know, well, the previous 3 years, they tore it up. And then this year, you know, they got upset by Oakland. No, it's been a struggle in the NCAA tournament for a while. And it goes back to what we were talking about, where you bring in the one and dones with all the potential. Got to be tested by fire. And so I think Cal gets to go and try this new thing of getting the 4 and 5 year transfer guys into Arkansas. The other thing about Arkansas that people may not know is you've got Walmart money, you've got Tyson Food money, mm-hmm. you got Jerry Jones money.
Yep.
And so the NIL at Arkansas is going to be really, really good. Now he had to take a little bit of a pay cut.
Yeah.
He's not getting paid as much. He's still the second highest paid coach. But he's not getting paid as much at Arkansas as what he got paid at Kentucky. Uh-huh. And here's the things I would give you. One, with the type of kids he was getting at Kentucky, are you getting the grit and the grinders?
Yeah.
I don't think you are. You're getting the five-star, the McDonald's All-American, and they're not maybe going to be willing to roll up the sleeves. Because if you go back, when Cal was Cal at UMass in Memphis, he had grit and grinders.
Yep.
And I think Cal goes back to that identity. He makes the necessary changes to be able to thrive in today's game. And I think both Arkansas and Kentucky are going to be winners in this thing because Kentucky's going to be able to get in somebody, whoever that may be. I have a feeling it's going to end up being Scott Drew. And I think Jerome Tang will end up back at Baylor. But my point being is I think it can be good for both programs.
Yeah, I think somebody said it's the best case scenario for everybody involved. Cal leaves before it gets really ugly. He gets to step into a really good position. Kentucky doesn't have to be the bad guy by forcing out the guy that's been there forever. They would never fire him because I think they said he had a $33 million buyout. You know, so they weren't going to fire him. I think it is kind of the rare win-win type of deal. You're talking about replacements. You know, Scott Drew is rumored. I did see something though, where Scott Drew's wife is very much she does not want anything to do with the limelight. Yes,
mm-hmm.
And you have to be kind of a college basketball equivalent of a first lady if you're going to be in Kentucky. And I think Scott Drew is a principled enough man from the things that I know about him. Never met the guy, obviously. I don't know, But I think that he may just say, look, and it's kind of the thing, and I thought about this, Tony. We are also at a day and age where you don't have to be at Kentucky, North Carolina, Indiana, UCLA to win a national championship anymore. Stores, Connecticut is kind of a town out in the middle of nowhere in a small state, and they've won 6 championships in the last 25 years. Baylor just won a championship a couple of years ago. Gonzaga out of Spokane, Washington is a power. And Scott Drew is, I'm sure, making more than enough money to make himself happy there at Baylor. Gone are the days where Kentucky can kind of come in and say, hey, we'll woo you off your feet with this and this and this. More often than not, if you've got a personality like Scott Drew, you say, you know, I'm good. I don't have to have this because I can have 75% of the financial comfort that I would get at Kentucky, but boy, I'm going to have 100% peace of mind at Baylor and not live in the constant chaos and swirl of Kentucky. So I do think it's his job if he wants it. However, I'm not going to be surprised, Tony, if he doesn't take it. What do you think about that?
I wouldn't be surprised either, you know, because I had also heard they had a kid that was, I think, a daughter that attends college in Texas. I don't know if she goes to Baylor or not. And then I think his sons are in high school. Uh-huh. And speaking from experience, it is hard to move high school kids.
Yep. Yep.
I it wouldn't surprise me. I know a name that's kind of out there. If Billy Donovan ends up taking it, I know, you know, he wanted the challenge of the NBA. I don't know if you saw the Bulls highlight last night where they tried to throw it all.
Oh, I heard about it on my walk today. I heard him talking about it on a podcast. Yeah.
It wouldn't surprise me if he called at halftime of that game to try to get an interview at Kentucky. But he was an assistant at Kentucky under Patino.
Yeah. I listening to a lot of pods and things like that. Billy Donovan, the reason why he got out of the college game was he was tired of the recruiting and chasing the kids and that type of thing. Well, it's changed quite a bit since he was at Florida. Yeah, it's got a lot worse. So I don't think he would come back. Here's a couple of people that I kind of thought about, Tony. What about Kelvin Sampson at Houston? Wouldn't that be a way for him to top off his career? Or I could see Chris Beard maybe looking at, but I had heard also somebody had said, he doesn't want to leave Ole Miss after 1 year, after being there for only 1 year. So
they took a chance on him when he got shown the door at Texas. So yeah, he might be a little bit loyal there.
Yep. There was another name. I was looking at my stuff today. Oh, well, I don't think he would do it, Tony. But a Kentucky type of guy is TJ Otzenberger.
Buyout is 16 or 17 million.
Oh, mamma mia.
Because that was Nate Oates was one they had mentioned, and I think Nate's is 18.
Yeah, yeah, that's a big chunk of change. I feel like there was one other name that I was looking at, like, I don't think Mark Few's going to leave Gonzaga, but if they don't get Scott Drew, then it's like, another rumored one is Mark Pope, who played on those 90s Kentucky teams with Patino, and he had a really, really good year at BYU. Now, BYU is not Kentucky, again, kind of the, I heard somebody say, Kentucky did the mid-major thing with Billy Gillespie, and that did not work out well. Uh-huh. I know who it was, Tony. I'm sorry. Buzz Williams.
Yeah. Buzz would be really good there.
Mm-hmm. I think he would know how to understand the media. He would recruit guys, but he would, yeah, I'd be interested in him. I know there's all sorts of things that they worry about at that level with buyouts and all that other stuff, but that was another name I thought, he's been kind of a little bit of a journeyman. And he's been at Texas A&M about as long as he was at Marquette, about as long as he was at Virginia Tech. So would he maybe look at making this as his last stop along the way? I don't know. So those are a couple other names. So
yeah, Buzz is interesting. That would be a good one. And then Kelvin Sampson, too.
Mm-hmm. So, last thing here today. Let's just keep this all. Let's not talk any. We'll have plenty of time to talk NBA. Tara Vanderveer, retiring yesterday, 45 years, 38 of them at Stanford, I think 14 Final Fours, 3 national championships, all-time leader, men's or women's in wins, just 96 Olympic coach, she's on the Mount Rushmore of women's basketball coaches, I think, Tony. Incredible career. Your thoughts.
Dare I say, Marty, underappreciated?
Absolutely.
You think that's fair?
No, I think that's really, really fair. I think she was with Gino and Pat doing what they did, you know, I think 11 and 8 titles apiece, if I'm correct. And I don't want to say she only has 3 national championships, but only 3 national championships. Now, a lot of times she was beat by those 2 coaches along the way. But I think vastly underrated in her accomplishments and the things that she did, without a doubt, her influence on the game, the players that she's coached. I think you hit the nail on the head, buddy.
You know, and the other thing I would go, I don't know how flashy she is. You know, like, Pat was larger than life. Gino's personality, huge. And she doesn't have that. The one thing that was kind of fun to see her, you know, with the generation that she was coaching, just hopping into some of the TikTok videos that the Stanford women, Cameron Brink, and some of them would put out there. And then she would have a little guest cameo there. But you could just tell her players love her. Mm-hmm. And she's strict, but she does it with compassion. Mm-hmm. And I just am very, very, I admire her a lot. I heard her speak one time.
Mm-hmm.
And
okay.
Don't get me wrong. It was good, but it's solid. And I think she just was a master of the basics. And that's maybe what separated her Stanford teams from some of the others. But, you know, it's sad when you see, you know, Gina with 11, Pat with 8, like, oh, but she only won 3.
Yeah.
You know, it's like
only,
you know,
yeah.
you win 3 in the men's side of things and you're on the Mount Rushmore.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think just the complete story of her career puts her on that Mount Rushmore level. Again, you have 1216 wins or something like that. Now she's going to get passed up pretty quick, by Gino next season. Cause I think he's only like 10 wins behind her or something like that. So, he's not behind by much. So, he will take that mantle, very quickly next season, you would assume. But, Stanford, it's not, like you said, she made, I don't mean this in a negative way in any way, shape or form. She made her players the team the center of the attention, whereas sometimes, again, kind of just based on the magnetism of their personalities, Gino and Pat were just as much of the story as was their teams, and their teams were outstanding and their players were outstanding. She kept the focus on the team, and she was kind of content to sit back into the shadows. Pat Summitt, she had the look, she had the stares on the sideline. Gino's Gino, you know, I think that she's just I think we're going to have an appreciation for her in a few years that we don't currently have, and hopefully the history of the game honors that.
She was almost, if you will, Marty, the anti Kim Mulkey.
Yes.
Where Mulkey makes it all about herself. She's as big, if not bigger, than her players and the team. And Vanderveer was very much about it being about her players. And she had some great players.
Dean Smith-esque?
Yeah.
Would that be a...
I think that's fair. I think that's a fair comparison. I would say he might be a little bit more revolutionary in terms of what he brought to the game, mm-hmm. you know, with the fast break system and the 4 corners and so on and so forth. Might have been a little bit more revolutionary that side of things. But in terms of like personality and makeup, I think that's a fair comp.
Yeah, just their personality, the way that they coach their teams, the way that they handle themselves in public, and you know, the media coverage and, you know, all those type of things. I think that's kind of who, because I think Dean Smith is criminally underrated by this next generation of coaches. You and I grew up with Dean Smith in North Carolina. Man, I remember when we were kids, Tony, Iowa went down and beat North Carolina in the first game in the Dean Dome, I think.
Barbel and Eddie Horton and B.J. Armstrong, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And that was like, not only were we playing at North Carolina, but that we beat North Carolina. Oh, nobody beats North Carolina in North Carolina. And so, yeah, I think that's a pretty fair comparison. I think we did all right on that one, Tony. Let's end at that point. How's that sound, buddy?
Genius.
I just can't get the briefcase open. So. Episode 81, lessons learned from the NCAA tournament. Tony, anything to go home with here today?
Offense wins.
Yep. Spoke it wisely. Like a guy who won 2-0 out on the pitch today. So episode 81. Hope you folks have enjoyed it. A lot of good stuff here. We'll be back at it next week. And just be ready to go. So coaches, as always, let's be sure to hone our craft one day at a time.